special gratitude to Bharati and Satyavrat Ganguly for so kindly inviting me to their beautiful home here in Calcutta. Dandavat Swami, Dandavat. And I thank all of you for so kindly coming. As I was walking in to this beautiful garden, I was requested to speak on two subjects, on the sannyas lila of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and some story about the book that I just wrote, The Journey Home. They are both quite extensive subjects, but I'll try to say something. We understand from the scriptures Vadanti tattva vidastattvam yajganu advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabdite. Srimad Bhagavat states in this particular sloka that those who are self-realized transcendentalists have realized that the absolute truth has three features eternally: Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Brahman is the all-pervading, impersonal, formless existence of the Lord, the divine light that is everywhere, within and without everything. Paramatma is the feature of the absolute truth or God that is seated within the heart of every living being as the witness and ultimately as the guide, if we can connect to that existence of the Lord within our hearts. And Bhagavan is the personality of Godhead who is eternally and simultaneously existing within the divine abode. Now about this Bhagavan, there's a beautiful sloka. Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir Ladini Shakti Rashma Ekat Manava Bibu Vibhavade Habidam Gadautau. That this one absolute truth eternally manifests in two forms, male and female. We see that everything within this creation has its origin in a male and female interconnection. Whether it's plants or animals or insects, wherever there's life, or humans. And according to the Bhagavat, the origin of that phenomena that we see everywhere within this existence is in the Absolute. The Absolute has both a male and female aspect for the purpose of divine lila or divine pleasure. Krishna is the supreme beloved, and Radha, the feminine aspect, is the supreme lover. Krishna is the supreme predominator, and Radharani is the supreme predominated. But the predominated conquers the predominator by love. This is Vrindavan philosophy. That love conquers the beloved. That love is so powerful and so pure that Krishna wants to taste the sweetness of Radha's love and wants to descend into this world and distribute the content of that love to everyone and to anyone in this age of Kali without considering a person's qualifications or disqualifications. Radha Bhava Duti Subalitam Nomi Krishna Swarupam. So this we understand to be Lord Chaitanya. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Radha Krishna Nahe Anya. Lord Chaitanya is Radha and Krishna in one form. Krishna coming to taste the sweetness of Radha's love and distributing that love to the world. And how he's distributing that love to the world? Through the Yuga Dharma. Golokera Prema Dana Hari Nam Sankirtana. That the name of God is non-different than the Lord. The scripture says, Nama Chintamani Krishna's Chaitanya Vigra. That the name of the Lord is a spiritual divine vibration that can reveal all aspects of the spiritual world to us if chanted with a humble and sincere heart. So Lord Chaitanya came for that purpose. And I'm going to be brief because there's two subjects I have to speak on. But the Lord appeared in Navadvip, not far from here. In fact, I just came from there a few hours ago. Where he hid his divine opulence of God for his own particular reasons, to show the qualities of a devotee. During Lord Chaitanya's early pastimes, he was Nimai Pandit. He was such a great scholar that he had, even when he was a young boy, a teenager, tens and thousands of students that were coming from all directions to learn from him. And the greatest of all scholars in all of India, Keshava Kashmiri, he came to conquer the pundits of Navadvip, and this little boy, Nimai, defeated him in scriptural debate. So at that time, Nimai's popularity grew tremendously. And he went to Gaya and took initiation from Ishwarapuri, and then he began the Sankirtan movement. And he delivered two of the most dastardly criminals, Jagai and Madhai, who literally controlled even the law because of their violence, their strength, and their fearfulness. And he made them, by his loving mercy and by giving them God's names, he made them into humble, sincere servants of every living being. This made him even more famous. And then there was a Chand Kazi, who was an official government agent in charge of that area, who outlawed the congregational chanting or Sankirtan. And Nimai, in one sentence, called the people of Navadvip to demonstrate, civil disobedience movement, nonviolent, to do Nam Kirtan to the Chankazi's house. Within an hour's time, hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people assembled. And they performed Nam Sankirtan. Lord Chaitanya was dancing and singing. He was so beautiful. They went right to Chankazi's house. Chankazi has outlawed any public Hindu practice. And Lord Chaitanya went right to his door and said, why are you doing? There's one God, We are all worshiping the same God. We are doing it our way. You're doing it your way. Why are you outlawing us? And they had a discussion. And in the end, Shankazi, with his arms raised, was chanting the names of Krishna. He understood the oneness of God, the unity of all religions. And he became a pure lover of God. And proclaimed, from this day on, myself and all my descendants, there will never be an obstruction to the Nam Sankirtan of Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya had a most beautiful wife, Vishnupriya. She was the very incarnation of Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune. Beautiful, chaste, and loving in every way. And his mother, she was a widow. Her husband had left this world. Her eldest son had left. All she had was her Nimai. And how she loved him. He was so loved. He was so successful. He was so powerful. At the age of 24, why would he want to give up all that to become a sannyasi? This is a very deep mystery. But understanding it is understanding the heart of the Absolute Truth. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chaduskritam dharma samstapanarataya sambhavami yuge yuge. The Bhagavad Gita tells us that the Absolute, or God, descends to deliver the pious, to reestablish principles of religion, and to annihilate the irreligions. But mostly, the predominant reason the Lord appears, which includes everything else, is to show compassion to those who are suffering the repetition of birth and death and everything in between within this world. To call us to our real eternal home, the home that is within all of our hearts. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sajya Kabunoi Sravanadi Sudhi Chiti Kori Yeyudoi. That love for God is within the heart of every living being. It simply needs to be awakened. And what is the nature of one who loves God? The Bhagavad Gita explains, Vidyavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gavihastini Suni Chaiva Swapake Cha Pandita Samadarshana. The one who has awakened their own inner self sees every living being with equal vision. Whether one is a Brahmin, whether one is a simple housewife or teacher or farmer, whether one is a cow or an elephant or a dog or an insect, wherever there's the presence of life is the presence of the soul. We are not these bodies. We are the conscious force that is animating and witnessing life through this body. We are not an eye, but we are seeing through the eyes, tasting through our tongues, loving through our hearts and thinking through our brains. What is the nature of the Atma, the soul? Bhagavad Gita tells, Mamaivam so jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. That the nature of the soul is part of God. On that spiritual platform, we are all brothers and sisters eternally. It's a secondary thing that a person may be Indian or American or Pakistani or Russian or Israeli or Palestinian or black or white or red or brown or yellow or man or woman. Well, one caste or another, these are secondary. The real principle, the real identity of all of us is we are all part of God. We are all an eternal soul, Satchit Ananda. And
And where there is love of God, there is the recognition of the essence within everyone, and there is spontaneous love for every living being. And how does love manifest within this world? In the form of compassion. Compassion means selfless. Kama is selfish. Compassion is selfless. Therefore, saintly persons are declared in the scripture to be paradukaduki, which means such a person, another person's happiness is my happiness. And another person's sadness is my sadness. That type of compassion gives ecstasy to the soul. Because in that compassion, we can actually access a divine grace beyond ourselves and be instruments of that divine grace in our service to all living beings. In the eighth canto of Srimad Bhagavat, in the section where Lord Shiva drinks an entire ocean of poison just to rescue the rest of the universe, it is said that there is no service, there's nothing anyone can do that is more pleasing to God than endure difficulties for the sake of showing compassion to others. This is a universal principle of all saintly persons, Jews or Christians or Muslims or Jains or Parsis or Hindus or all different branches of Hindus. To be an instrument of compassion without discrimination. So when the Lord appears to demonstrate the highest degrees of compassion. Lord Chaitanya was being criticized and ridiculed and even hated by people who were envious of him because of his great success. Or people who had very, very materialistic conceptions of their religion, and they were being exposed by a pure, compassionate teacher. There were threats against him. There were horrible rumors being circulated against him. Can you imagine if 500 years ago, if they had internet, what facility these people would have? Now the Lord, he had no hatred. He had no vengeance for any of them. Rather, he expressed to his devotees. He said, the medicine, Pipalikanda, is meant to cure the disease by removing the excess congestion. But what I find is happening is that medicine is increasing the disease. And he explained, I came with the medicine of divine grace and the holy name. And I came to to cure the disease of material egoism. To cure the disease of avidya, ignorance. But what I find is people are now going against the very doctor and rejecting the medicine. In fact, the medicine is making people worse. And then Lord Chaitanya thought, because this was 500 years ago when the culture of India was somewhat different than now. He said, if right now people see I'm a Grihastha, a householder just like them, and they take me to be someone very ordinary. But if I take sannyas, then everyone will bow to me. And when they bow to me, all their offenses will be removed, and then their hearts will be open to receive my grace and prema bhakti, love of God, will awaken from within them. But as associates, we're pleading with him, what about us? You're going to leave us forever? And what about your wife? She's only hardly 15 years old, and she knows nothing but you. And your mother, 67 years old, she has no one but you. Lord Chaitanya met his mother. Can I tell the story? She heard a rumor that my son's going to take sannyas. Sachi Devi approached him in a secluded place. Her heart was in turmoil. She prayed, "Oh Gauranga, my son, your face is beautiful and radiant like the golden moon. Your eyes are like the petals of a fully blossomed lotus flower. Your nose is like the freshly ripened sesame flower. Your lips, they are like the fresh bimba fruit, and your teeth are like rows of pearls. And your hair, your beautiful hair, like elegant silk that cascades across your beautiful broad golden shoulders and curls around your moon-like face, always decorated with malati flowers. When I hear the sweet nectar of your words, when I see the beautiful gayet of your walk, it gives me the greatest joy. What have I heard? Is this true, that you're going to leave me forever to become a sannyasi? Understand my plight. I had 8 daughters, and each and every one of them died just after birth. Now, all of you who are mothers, you understand. When you love your child, when you really want to be a mother, when that child is in your womb, it's more dear than everything in life to you. You're nourishing it. You're praying for it. And when that child is born, a beautiful infant girl, and you're holding it in your hands, what is the motherly love? She had 8 such daughters, and they died right after birth. And then finally she had a son named Vishwaroop. But when they were just about ready to get him married as a teenager, without saying anything to anyone, he left home and became a sannyasi. Sachi Mata said, and then my husband, Jagannath Mishra, Lord Narayan took him away and brought him to the spiritual world. You're all I have. If you leave me, I have nothing to live for. Please stay in Navadweep. You have so many friends. You have so much fun chanting and dancing together. Please stay. What kind of religious principle is this? To leave your mother to die in separation. Is that religion? Is that what you have descended to teach the world? And what about your wife? I'm going to die soon. I'm 67 years old. But Vishnupriya is 15. She will have to suffer for so many long years in your separation. Why do you want to do this? Please stay home. And the Lord explained to her very tenderly that we are never separated. You are my eternal mother. Long ago, you were Prishni, and I was your son, Prishni Garba. You were Devahuti, and I was your son, Kapila. You were Kaushalya, and I was your beloved son, Ramchandra. You were Devaki and Yashoda, and I was your son, Krishna. Please understand, my dear mother. Our love is eternal. But there are so many people in this world who have forgotten that love. They are in a world where at any moment there could be betrayal, disease, earthquakes, wars, floods, droughts, animosity. This is not their home. Within our own hearts is the spiritual world, the eternal soul. I have descended to give them the opportunity to understand the eternal and pure joys of love, love of God, and love for each other. Our love is eternal, but I must do this to reach the conditioned souls. I must reach out to those who have rejected me, who hate me, and give them the highest spiritual joy. And then the Lord revealed to Yashoda, to Sachimata, his form of Shamsundar, standing in a threefold bending form with the body of a complexion of a freshly formed monsoon rain cloud, with a flute to his lips, playing the fifth note. Satyamata wept in ecstasy to see this form. But still, because she so much identified with Lord Gauranga as her son, she fell at his feet and cried. The Lord said, I cannot leave without your permission. But think about all the suffering people in the world. And I promise you, whenever you think about me, whenever you cook for me, you will personally see me manifest within your heart to reciprocate with your love. Sachimata gave her permission, as did Vishnupriya. The Lord left the most ideal, wonderful situation anyone could possibly have to put on the drab robes of a sannyasi and go to the forest with a begging bowl. To beg the conditioned, suffering souls of this world to just accept his grace. And that was his life, to beg people, just accept this grace. Chant Krishna's names. Worship Krishna. Speak about Krishna. Krishna's your mother. Krishna's your father. Krishna's your real wealth. Krishna's the very treasure of life. Krishna is your breath and your very life and soul. Please accept this love that is within your heart. Here is the Supreme Absolute Truth, the source of the Vishwarupa of the 11th chapter of the Gita, who is devouring all living entities in the form of time. Here is that Supreme Lord, who is the source of Narasimhadev, who tore Hiranyakashipu to pieces. Ram, who annihilated Ravana. That same one Lord has now appeared as a sannyasi beggar, putting straw between his teeth in humility to beg people, don't suffer anymore. The holy name is such a simple way to awaken this love. And then he gave the formula, such a simple formula. There are volumes, hundreds of volumes of books describing the philosophy and the science of Lord Chaitanya's message. But he made it very simple also. Trinarapi suniche na taror iba sehishnana amani na mana dena kirtaniya sadahari. Just aspire to be humble like a blade of grass. Tolerant and forgiving like a tree. The tree in the summer is standing directly in the sunlight to give us shade. In the winter, the tree stands in the cold, where I'm from, Chicago, covered by ice, to give its limbs for wood to keep us warm and cook our food. And even if you cut down the tree's body, which means taking away its home, it gives you wood to build your home. Such is the quality of a tree. Amani namana dena. Offer all respect to others. Don't expect any respect for yourself. If you just have these qualities, Lord Chaitanya said, you will find the absolute supreme qualities of God within the holy name. You will taste such nectar, such ecstasy in that name. Param drisva nivartate. All our greed, all our lust, all our arrogance, all our envy will be washed away by the sweet nectar of the holy name. And love of God will awaken. The Lord was begging people, please just accept this message. And he left his family and his devotees and everyone else to weep in separation. In the Lord's heart, he was feeling the same as them. Krishna left Vrindavan because of the opposition of Kamsa, Jarasandha, Shishupal. The residents of Vrindavan felt deep separation. And in Kurukshetra, when the Lord met them, Krishna told them, I'm feeling the same separation from you as you are to me. Why? The Gita explains, Yegatamam pratam prapadyante tams tathaiva bhajamyaham. That as you approach me, I reciprocate accordingly. But that vipralamba, that love and separation, is when our love for God goes so deep inside of us, and there the Lord embraces us and reciprocates. In the same way, the Lord, for the sake of rescuing people who were antagonistic against him, he became a sannyasi and wandered about begging people to accept his grace. This year, we are commemorating the 500th anniversary of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's expressing this divine compassion for all living beings. Now part two, that I've been asked to speak about this book, it's called The Journey Home. I was asked to write this book by a friend of mine who was on his deathbed. He was dying of melanoma cancer. His name was Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj. He said, why are you not writing a book about your memoir of your travel to India? I said, Maharaj, I don't like to write a book about me. If I have to write about something, let me write about someone else. And he told me that if this book will help other people to find deeper meaning and fulfillment in life, then it is arrogant of you to not write it.
and he became very sweet. The tears glistened in his eyes, and he held my hand from his deathbed and said, "Please promise me you will write this book." So I promised. So I wrote the book. I'll speak one aspect of this book, with your permission. How much time do I have?
Endless.
You are so polite, thank you. I'll speak briefly. At least that's my intention. I was born in 1950 in Chicago. And when I was 4 years old, my parents brought me to a very, very peaceful village about 30 miles north of Chicago. I had two brothers. And it was a very nice place to live. But everyone was really materialistic. And everyone was religious in a materialistic way. But as far as really deeply trying to understand what is the essence of Dharma and God, I never met anyone like that. But when I was a teenager in the 1960s, it was an extremely turbulent time in America. The Vietnam War was raging. In fact, so many of my friends were forcibly drafted into the army to fight the war. And nobody believed we should be there. The youth of America considered it a useless war. Why should we go there and die? And hundreds and thousands were dying. When I got out of high school, I was eligible for the draft. If you don't go to the draft, if you don't go to the army, you get put in jail. That's the two choices. Go to fight a war you hate, or you get put in jail. And then you may never get a job for the rest of your life because it's on your record. That was the situation. So the young generation, many revolted against the government, revolted against the status quo. And at the same time, there was a civil rights movement of Martin Luther King, where many people were marching for the freedom of the African American people. They were prisoners of the ghetto. They may have been free from slavery from the Civil War, but they were kept prisoners in the ghetto, and they had no chance to get out in the 1950s and early 60s. And in the South, they weren't allowed to go to the same schools, drink from the same water fountain, use the same toilet, or sit in the front of the bus. Why is this happening? What is this human psychology? All this greed, all this war, all this hatred, all this discrimination? It created a whole counterculture of questioning everything. And I was part of that. And I joined the civil rights movement and marched for the African American people. And my fellow white brothers were throwing rocks and stones at me. But it was an honor. It's an honor to be persecuted for an ideal that you believe in. But gradually I came to realize that the solution to all these problems has to have a deeper place. All of these problems, and today the problem of the ecology and the environmentalism and the terrorism and the racial discrimination and the religious conflicts and the greed in the corporate world. The
the causes of very polluted ecology within people's hearts. So much greed, so much arrogance. I could see that then. And I wanted to find a spiritual solution because I felt that's the only real solution. Everything else is patchwork. And this little spark of spiritual inclination started growing and growing and growing as I was seeing the world. So myself and my lifelong friend named Gary. Now, if you don't believe what I'm about to tell you, I'll bring Gary here and he'll tell you, he'll confirm it. And he's not a Hare Krishna devotee either. My friend Gary and I were very dear friends from 10 years old, and in high school we were best of friends. We used to travel around together looking for meaning and fulfillment in life and trying to really meet people and connect to people. So we decided to go to Europe for 3 months during the summer break. I was then going to college. I was a freshman in college. I finished the freshman year, and I told my mother and father, who were such loving, caring parents, that if I didn't call them on time once a week when I was on college, they would practically be disassembled mentally with anxiety and worry for me. I think they were like Bengali parents. Very worrying, very caring. And I told them, I'm going to Europe for 3 months. Ah, they didn't want me to go. But I was a child of the 60s, so I went anyway. I told them, I'll come back for college, but I have to try to find myself. I need to separate myself from the environment I've grown up in America and see how other people live. See how people from other countries, other races, other religions, how they view life, how they view each other, and how they view God. I need to do this. So they gave me their reluctant blessing. In Europe, I was thinking I'll find God by enjoying material things more than ever before, because now I was completely free. I had no guardians whatsoever. But I realized that the whole social scene was only taking me farther away. I remember sitting in London on the banks of the River Thames, late at night, just watching the river flow, evaluating what my life was about. And I'd look up at that big clock, Big Ben, and wonder, am I just wasting my time? In Italy, I had a very, very beautiful experience praying to Jesus in a beautiful cathedral, Santa Maria di Fiori. And gradually, Gary and I, who were just together through thick and thin, by the way, we had no money. We had one person who came with us who had money to sponsor the whole trip, and the first day in Luxembourg, he was robbed, and he went home. So Gary and I were with nothing. We would hitchhike and sleep under trees, or we'd meet people and they'd let us stay with them in their houses. But it's a good way to get to know people. Our spiritual longings brought us to the point where we lived on the Greek island of Crete in a cave. We were roommates in a cave. It was a very nice cave. As far as caves goes, it was a 5-star cave. It had kind of a high ceiling, and it was a very nice cave. And every day I would climb a mountain before sunrise and meditate, pray, and study scriptures till sunset, and he would go down to the seaside, the Mediterranean Sea, to do the same thing. And after the sunset, we'd meet in the cave, and we'd just share our realizations of the day. Should I continue? Oh, thank you, thank you. I was really hoping you'd say that. So, one day, on this day, I was just feeling such deep longing for spiritual experience. I was crying and praying, God, show me the way. And in the midst of a beautiful sunset, I heard a voice. A voice that changed my entire life. A voice that shocked me, but gave me hope. A voice that put my life on the line between birth and death. A voice that put me in a situation where to follow it, I have to accept a whole new identity and leave everything behind. That voice spoke from within and said, go to India. I was wondering, I have no money. I can't ask my parents to help me with something they don't want me to do. And I don't know where India is. And I don't even have a map. But I believed if I just keep hitchhiking. Do you all know what hitchhiking is? It means going like this and someone picks you up or doesn't pick you up. If I just keep doing that east direction, someday I'll arrive in India. So I went down to the cave and I met with Gary. And I said, Gary, something amazing happened to me today. And Gary said to me, something amazing happened to me today. And I said, what? Tell me. He said, right at sunset, I heard a voice. I became very excited. I said, what did he say? He said, I was told, go to Israel. I said, what? Say that again. Where? He said, Israel, don't you believe me? Don't you believe me that I heard this voice? I said, I believe you, but he told me to go to India. So there was silence for maybe 20 minutes. I was looking at the stars. By that time it was dark. On that Greek island. And I remember looking up at the stars and talking to God. I didn't know who he was or where he was, but I believed he heard me. I said three words. I said, yes, I am willing. And then I told Gary, I'm leaving for India tomorrow. And the next morning, I parted from my lifelong friend. He tried to convince me not to go. He said, it's very dangerous going through the Middle East. Come with me to Israel. We'll get a job. We'll make some money. Then we'll take a bus to India. But how can you go with no money, nothing? You don't even have a spare set of clothes. I said, but this calling was so loud in my heart. I couldn't say no. Some things in life, some experiences, are beyond logic. They're intuitive. They're given to us as a gesture of grace. When I think back, why did I do that? There's only one answer. I had no choice. I was literally consumed by that yearning for God. So we parted. We were both crying. Lifelong friends. We went through so much together, and especially our travels through Europe, we really bonded. But now he was going west and I was going east. Different directions. I hitchhiked through Turkey. Now, if you read the book, it wasn't easy hitchhiking through Turkey. But many very dangerous, life-threatening conditions that came upon me. But they were such a blessing because I didn't enjoy it at all when it was happening. The realizations and the lessons and the wisdom that comes out of such situations is a gift of God. Every situation that comes upon us is an opportunity to grow or an opportunity to shrink or an opportunity to just stay where we are. It's just a matter of how we interpret it. From a spiritual perspective, we learn to see every situation as a gift and try to find the inner essence of what we're meant to learn in this situation, how we're meant to grow. We don't like storms, but without the storms, nothing grows. Sometimes we go out and we say, I wish it would stop raining. But then if it doesn't rain, nothing grows. There's a drought, and we're saying, I wish it would rain. So the storms of life are really meant to make the seeds of wisdom, the seeds of realization, and the seeds of love grow within us. If we just understand it and process it in that light. From Turkey, I entered into Iran. There I studied under a master. I studied Islam and the Quran. While in Europe, I was studying Christianity and Judaism, as well as in America. Then I entered into Afghanistan. I hitchhiked to Herat and then Kandahar. Can I tell you one or two stories from Kandahar? One day, I met this man named Hariz, and he was a very wealthy Afghani person, and he had traveled around the world because he had a business of trade, and he welcomed me to be a house guest of his. And he was very philosophical. So we used to sit on his rooftop, his terrace, and discuss philosophy. He was a very, very sophisticated, aristocratic gentleman. One day, as we're talking, it was nighttime, he said to me in very distinguished Afghani English, he said, my name was Richard then, he said, Sir, Mr. Richard, please excuse me, but there's an important responsibility I have to fulfill. I'll be right back. Then he got up from his chair, lifted his head toward the moon, and began to howl. Awoo! Did that 3 times. But I'm only going to do it once, because it seems like we're disturbing the neighbors. I was thinking, this man has gone mad. What happened to him? And then he runs over to the rooftop, picks up a rope, throws it down to the bottom of the house, waits a few minutes, then pulls the rope up. And in a little loop in the bottom of the hole, he brought up a mongoose. And the mongoose was wiggling around, and then he let the mongoose off on the rooftop. And he sat down again, and we began talking philosophy. And I was wondering, why he did that? As we're talking, the mongoose starts crawling up my back. They have very sharp claws. You don't know how sharp mongoose's claws are until they crawl up your back. And I have very long hair then. It was halfway down my back. Because wearing long hair in the West was a statement of discontent for all the violence, all the racism, and all the materialism. Egoistic materialism. So this mongoose crawled all the way up to my neck, into my hair, and made my hair at his nest. Then he curled up and went to sleep. It's quite heavy. And I was really, like, suffering, actually. So I said to Hariz, what am I supposed to do now? And he smiled. He said, my mongoose made a good nest in your hair. He seems very happy. And I said, well, maybe he's happy, but I'm not. I said, can you get him off me? He became very serious. He sipped in his cup of tea. In Afghanistan, the way they make tea is they don't put milk in it. They just put a cube of sugar. He put the tea down, leaned back, and said, Mr. Richard, there's an old saying. Never wake a sleeping mongoose. Because mongooses are ferocious when they're angry. They will kill even the cobra, which is the symbol of death. He said, I warn you, don't even move. He may tear your head to shreds. He said, there's nothing I can do about it. I did not plan for him to do this. So we talked for some time, and the night was getting later, and he said, please forgive me, I have to go to sleep. So he went to sleep, and I was sitting up there, and this mongoose was really heavy, and I was afraid to move. And then I was thinking, well, at least somebody likes my long hair. And then these insects started biting me, because he had friends with him, all these little insects on his body. And I was really, really in anguish. Why is this happening to me? I was 19 years old at the time, just a little teenager. God, why is this happening? I'm on a spiritual journey to find you, and now this mongoose is like a time bomb that could rip me to shreds at any moment. And then something wonderful happened. I just changed my thinking. I was really suffering, and I was... Why is this happening to me? And what am I supposed to do? This is horrible. I was scared. I was uncomfortable. And then I just changed my thinking. There must be a reason for this. What am I supposed to learn? And then something arose within my heart. It was something beautiful. That we all have, at every moment, the choice to convert a blessing into a curse or a curse into a blessing. What is the blessing in this? If I look for a blessing, I'll find it. In the Bible it says, seek and ye shall find. In the Gita, Krishna says, if you search for me, you will find me. What is the lesson I'm supposed to learn here? That by the willingness to be forbearing and tolerant of difficulties and look for the wisdom in a situation is divine. With that understanding, I found deep peace. My neck was still aching the same way. The bugs were still biting me the same way. The mongoose still could rip my head in shreds the same way. But now I was actually very happy because I felt I was spiritually growing, because I was welcoming a lesson, a wisdom to grow with. And about 5 or 6 hours later, when the sun was rising, the mongoose climbed down off my back, jumped in the ground, and looked at me with affection. It was like he was really grateful for it. And I looked at him with affection. And then Hariz woke up and he put him back in the rope and threw him downstairs. Another day in Kandahar. Since you said I have forever. I was sitting in a tea stall. There was about 5 or 6 very, very poor peasants. At that time, in 1970, Afghanistan was the poorest country I had ever seen in the world. But believe it or not, of anywhere I had ever been up until I came to India, they were the most hospitable, peaceful, and friendly people I ever met in the world. We all just crouched down on a clay floor in a little tea stall, which is just a shack. And they gave me some tea. We're drinking together. They had their turbans and their long clothes, all in tatters and rags. And I couldn't understand a word of them. But somehow they liked me and I liked them. And then a boy came in. He may have been 12 or 15 years old. He was blind, but in a very gross-looking way. He had nothing covering his very, very disfigured, mutilated eyes. It was ghastly to see his eyes. And he was in absolute poverty. He was very skinny. His clothes were tattered rags. And he had a little instrument, a musical instrument. It was just a piece of wood. And there was a wire, a piece of wire, thin wire, musical wire, a string, that was nailed on one side and then nailed on another side with a little can to kind of give it an acoustical sound. And he thumped on that one string instrument and sang songs of love for Allah. And he sang with such emotion, with such devotion, with such joy. He was smiling and he was crying in ecstasy as he was singing for about a half hour. And all of us on the floor were enthralled. I was thinking, I never saw anyone so happy in my life. That was a culture shock for me. What is happiness? Whether we're rich or whether we're poor or anything in the middle. Happiness is a state of the heart. Happiness has little to do with things. You can have or not have and be miserable, or you could have or not have and be in bliss. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, an intelligent person understands that they are illumined within, they rejoice within, they find their happiness within. And what is within? Our relationship with God, our essence, our love. So I continue traveling through Kabul and then through Pakistan. Then I came to India. After 6 months of hitchhiking from London to Ferozpur, which is on the Punjabi border, I finally made it. And I was reading so many books about India, their spirituality. As I was approaching that immigration desk, oh, my heart was just soaring. I finally made it. After risking my life, after practically being murdered, after being in getting countless diseases, I finally made it to the place that I'm going to call my home. The land of the yogis, the land of the sadhus, the land of the mystics, the land of the lamas. As I was walking toward that immigration desk, my heart was flying to the river Ganges. It was flying to the Himalayan mountains. It was flying to the hermitages of the sages. Such anticipation. And there was a lady in drab military uniform. She looked at me and said, "Give me your passport." She looked through every page of my passport. And she looked at me with a very cold stare and said, "Show me how much money you have." I became nervous. I just had a little cloth bag about this big. And I only had some coins. Some of them were gilded. One was a gulden from Holland. Another was a drachma from Greece. Another was a pence from England. I didn't have any money, but I was like collecting the lowest denomination of coins just so that I can show my parents all the places I went and everything. So I had some of these. I had some one little Afghan coin. And she said, "You require minimum $200 to enter India. Show me your $200. I said, "This is all I have." She said, "Then you are denied." I begged her. I've traveled 6 months. Dandavat, Maharaji, Dandavat. I've traveled 6 months to get here. Please, I want to learn about your people. I want to see the beauty of your culture. Just give me a chance. She said, "We have beggars enough in India. We don't want another beggar like you. Go home." She wouldn't let me leave. I waited hours and hours until finally, when night was coming, there was a shift, and a Sikh gentleman took the post. And she specifically told him, "Don't let him in." And I went to him, and he told me, "Get out from here." And I cried. It wasn't fake tears either. I cried. I want to learn about your culture. I want to meet your people. I want to find about your spiritual heritage. Please give me a chance. Someday I'll try to do something good for your people. Just give me a chance. And his heart softened. He stamped my passport, put his hand on his head, and blessed me.
May you find what you are crying for. Welcome to India.
Much happened. There's a whole book if you want to read it. But I traveled to the Himalayas. And there I was living in caves and living in the bank of the Ganga. And I was trained to live as a sadhu. Now I was just a 20-year-old boy, all alone. And I live with many famous people, many who no one has ever heard. I traveled around, learned from various different teachers. In Dehradun, I lived with Anandamayi Ma. In Rishikesh, I lived with Tatwala Baba. I met with Jay Krishnamurti and Swami Rama, Swami Sachidananda, and Swami Chidananda Saraswati, the descendant of Swami Shivananda. I met Mr. Iyengar, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Kailash Baba. In Calcutta, I met with Mother Teresa. In Dharamshala, I studied under the Lamas and Dalai Lama of Tibet. In Bodh Gaya, I studied under a Zen master and then Satyanarayan Goenkaji. I took his courses, Vipassana meditation. And I lived with many Shivites, Ram Bhaktas. I was very open in how much I appreciated everything everyone taught me. But I was still searching and searching. I lived with Swami Muktananda, Ganesh Puri. I visited Kalighat Temple here in Calcutta. Eventually, I went to Nepal and I was studying Tibetan Buddhism there in a place called Swayambhunath. Have any of you ever been to Swayambhunath? There's a monkey temple. And I was living close to some lamas who were teaching me, and monks. And in those days, it's a temple on a mountain, and all around it was rice paddies. There was nothing else. I don't know what it's like today. But one day I just decided I'm going to take a walk. And I walked all the way to Kathmandu, a few kilometers, and then I started walking back. Now, it happened to be the monsoon rain season. And I saw above me these very dark, bluish clouds swirling around and forming in the sky. And then I heard thunder, and I saw lightning, and it started to drizzle. And I had already endured several monsoon storms in the middle of fields. And I only had one set of clothes. Some sadhu clothes that someone gave me. So I was looking for a tree to protect me, but because it was rice paddies, there was no trees. But then I happened to see what appeared to be a little old man with an umbrella walking in that very thin border between the rice paddies. So I was thinking, I'm going to go under that umbrella. So I had to really... You can't run on those little thin rice paddies, but I walked as fast as I could to catch up with him before it started pouring rain. And I caught up to him, and I was right behind him. But because of the nature of how thin it was, yes? Because of the nature, I couldn't go next to him. I had to be behind him, and he couldn't look back. So for about 10 minutes, we walked together. Two people, all alone, under a single umbrella, in a massive rice paddy, under a torrential monsoon rainstorm. Finally, the rain stopped. was just a downpour. And I actually had to go a different direction. And I said, thank you. And for the first time, the person turned around. And we looked at each other. He dropped his umbrella in the mud. We both gasped. It was Gary, my lifelong friend. I said, Gary. He said, my name. We were shocked. We couldn't even talk for some time. And then he told me he went to Israel. And he worked on a kibbutz and made money and then took a bus called the Magic Bus from Istanbul to Delhi. And because it was so hot in Delhi, he and some of his friends who were on the Magic Bus decided to go to Kathmandu. And then in Kathmandu, they looked around and they met somebody who was renting a house in a village not far from Swayambhunath. So he took me there. And when I went there, they were playing all Western music and smoking ganja. And I said, Gary, you could do this in America. You came to India, the land of spirituality. By that time, I was really a hardcore sadhu, trained by other sadhus. I said, come with me and I will teach you the life of a sadhu. So he left his friends and came with me. And we were traveling together. Now in those days, the way sadhus traveled is third class Indian trains. The thing about third class Indian trains in 1970-71 is they were so crowded that no ticket collector could possibly get in. So it was free. And there was no bars in the windows. The train would come, and everybody would be running as fast as they could alongside the train and then jumping through the windows. Of course, you all know this better than me. But it was really a culture shock living in America, jumping in train windows when they're moving. But I trained up Gary how to do these things. And we decided to go to Amarnath because there was a pilgrimage for Lord Shiva, and we were told by one sadhu at Pashupatinath that if you go to this Amarnath during this time, all your spiritual wishes will be fulfilled. And I had so many spiritual wishes that I really wanted fulfilled. So I said, let's go. So we were going by third class train. We went through Varanasi, Patna, and then, I'm sorry if I'm taking too long, but I'll end soon. All of a sudden, there was a massive rainstorm, and the train was in the middle of some fields, and the fields flooded. The train was so packed with people. There were no seats. There was not even any place to crouch up in the luggage racks. We were just standing like this. No food, no water. And we were trapped in that field for about 20 hours in a flood until the flood receded and the locomotive steam engine stagnancy does something to the human mind. And movement is such a relief. When you're moving forward, when you're going somewhere. Finally, at about 5 o'clock in the morning, after so many hours, the train stopped at this station. We had no idea where we were, but Gary and I decided we're going to go out and breathe air. And we're going to get some water. And we're going to move our limbs because we were crushed for about 30 hours. So we had to climb over people's heads to get to the window, and we crawled out, and we got some water, and we breathed. And then the whistle blew. And then we tried to get back in. Every window we dove into, we just bounced off a wall of people. We tried to get into the doors, And there were people, like five people outside the door making a wall, holding on to the railings. We tried at least 10 different places to somehow or other dive in, but we couldn't. The train was gone. Gary said, "Where are we?" I said, "I don't know." Soon all the people who were in the railway platform, they all left. People came coming off the train, people who couldn't get on the train. And I happened to see some sadhus sitting around a little fire on the ground. And I walked up to them. And one, he looked like he knew me. He just stood up and welcomed me. And I said, "Where am I?" He said, "This is Mathura. And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday." No, I wasn't a devotee of Krishna or anything like that. But he invited us to come to the Janmasthan to celebrate Krishna's birthday, which we did. It's a long story. But what happened is, during the celebrations, I kept hearing this word, Vrindavan, Vrindavan, Vrindavan. Everyone was talking. And I was staying at Vishram. We slept at Vishramghat that night. We bathed in the Yamuna. And as I was bathing in the river Yamuna, something came upon me. I have to go to Vrindavan, but I have to go alone. So I told Gary, "I'm going to Vrindavan, and you should meet me there tomorrow." So I walked to Vrindavan. And I was walking through the forest there, seeing the cows and the peacocks and the parrots and Yamuna, and seeing all these little girls carrying baskets of cow dung on their head and smiling and dancing and saying, "Radhe, Radhe, Radhe, Radhe." And I was thinking, this is home. There was something magical. And the next day, Gary came and we met. But Vrindavan was very crowded because it was just after Janmashtami. Gary said, "I don't want to be with crowds." I said, "Well, why don't you go to Haridwar? And in 3 days, I'll meet you there at the Brahma Ghat on the bank of the Yamuna under the clock. And then we'll go to Amarnath together." So we hardly even said goodbye because we were going to meet in 3 days. So the day before leaving, I was sleeping on the bank of the Yamuna River on the ground. And I remember praying to God. "I love this Vrindavan so much. Maybe someday I'll return. God, whatever is your will, please let it be. But tomorrow I'm leaving to meet Gary." The next morning, I heard the temple bells ringing. I couldn't move. I had a blazing fever. And I was nauseous like I've never been before. It was a stabbing pain in my stomach. I couldn't stand up. I just laid there for hours. Vultures were circling around me overhead, waiting for me to die of this fever. And I remember, while I'm looking up at those vultures, suffering like anything on this riverbank, why did I leave my comfortable, beautiful home in America? It was so nice. Protective parents. I had so many good friends. Here I am, all alone, dying. And then one Brijabasi, he happened to come by with an ox cart and looked at me and felt my head and picked me up and threw me in the back of his ox cart and brought me to a charitable hospital, which actually was worse. But then, the The doctor told me I had typhoid fever. And he said, you cannot travel for at least a month. Otherwise, you will die. So I stayed in Vrindavan. And just living among the people. At first, I stayed in an ashram. And then I started just staying in the bank of the Yamuna under a Kadamba tree. And just traveling around and meeting the people and trying to understand and what is bhakti, what is Radha, what is Krishna. And I was roaming about to different holy places. And I decided the path of bhakti is what I want to follow. This philosophy is so much satisfying my heart, and it so much includes all other philosophies I learned. Harmonizing and including without disrespecting. And I decided to stay for the rest of my life. But this is a very long story, the different saints I met in Vrindavan. But then my visa expired and I had to leave. After about 9 months, I had to leave. I could not extend my visa beyond. So I went to Nepal. The first time I was in Nepal, I visited a wonderful place. It's not far from here. Have any of you been to Janakpur or Mithila? It's the birthplace of Sita, the place where Ram and Sita met and were married. There, I read Valmiki's Ramayana and Tulsidas's Ramacharitamanas. From sunrise to sunset, I just sat and read the Ramayana. So I returned to Nepal. And I remember going back to that rice paddy where I had met my friend and wondering whatever happened to him. The poor boy, he didn't know anything about India except I was his guide, and I was supposed to meet him in Hardwar, and I couldn't meet him, so I didn't know what happened to him. But none of us had addresses. We obviously didn't have cell phones, so there was no communication. And then I got a 2-week transit visa where I was to catch. I wrote to my parents and said, either I could hitchhike back, which will take me 6 months, or you can send $350 to the American Express office in Kathmandu, and then I'll fly back. That's all it cost in those days, because I still have all those. My parents kept all the letters. So when I went to Kathmandu, there was a money order for $350. But something really interesting happened. I realized I forgot how to spend money because it was years since I had money. So I just kind of kept it for the ticket, and I still lived in caves and begged for food as a sadhu. So I decided to take the scenic route back, and I went to Pokhara Valley. Beautiful, beautiful place, the Annapurna mountain range. And I found a cave. This was really a nice cave. It was on the face of a cliff. And nobody had been in that cave probably for 100 years. But there were carved murtis of Sita, Ram, Lakshman, and Hanumanji right outside the cave. And underneath the cave, a distance, was a river, a loud river flowing. So I lived in that cave. And every day I would go to the Fiwala Lake, and people would give me this free little boat made out of a carved trunk of a tree, and I would go to the middle and I would read Bhagavad Gita and Ramayana and chant God's names from sunrise to sunset. The next day my visa was ending. So I said goodbye after sunset, and I was walking back to my cave, which was really in a completely desolate, secluded place. To get there, you had to climb down a cliff. Should I continue? Thank you. It was pitch dark, and I'm walking. There was just some moonlight. And I was 1 foot down the cliff, and there was a dirt road that led to Pokhara, the town, which was a few kilometers away. And a bus just roared down that road, a single bus. There was no other traffic. And the lights flashed on me just when I was 1 foot climbing down the cliff. And suddenly, a little way down the road, the bus stopped, and I heard somebody scream. And then I saw two bodies running toward me. And I thought, maybe, you know, they saw a white person and they're coming to rob me or something. They're not going to get much. So I didn't know what to do. So these two people were running, and I was looking, and I was wondering, should I run away? And then as they came closer and closer, I recognized it was Gary in the middle of nowhere. And he told me, well, actually, we embraced, and we were crying. And behind him was one of my college classmates named Hackett. His name was Steve, but he looked like a famous American comedian named Buddy Hackett, so we called him Hackett. This was a culture shock, seeing my classmate. I brought him down to my cave to spend the night. I tried to give whatever hospitality I had. I begged for some chipped rice and river water, and I gave him some of that. And we were reviewing because it was about 9 months since we met last. And he was living like a sadhu for those 9 months. And he said that he met Hackett in Delhi. He said he was at this hotel, because Gary had some money. He was at a hotel for cheap rooms, and there was public bathrooms where everybody, you know, took shower in the same room. And there was one naked person that he recognized, and it was his classmate, Hackett. He came. He heard that we were in India somehow or other, and he came all the way to India overland by bus to look for us. And he met Gary. They were standing next to each other naked in a shower, and they recognized each other. So they were in Kathmandu, and they decided to go trekking in the mountains. That's why they were coming to Pokhara. And they were both sleeping in the bus, and Gary said he just woke up for a second, and he saw the headlights flash for just a moment as he woke up, right when he opened his eyes, and he saw me in the light of the headlights. That was only a second. So he stopped the bus and came out. But I had to leave the next morning. So I left. And I didn't see Gary or hear about him for many, many years. I'm going to tell you another story now. And then I'm going to end. There was a very nice Christian monk who lived near Srirangam in South India, Tiruchirappalli. His name was Father Bede Griffiths. He was considered the father of interfaith for the Catholic Church. And we became very, very good friends. And he told me he was going to California to give a seminar to the Benedictine Catholic monks in a place called Big Sur. And he asked if I would give some lectures for them on the Ishopanishad. So I said, I happen to be in California this summer, so I'll come up. So we fixed a date. So I was driving with a friend. This friend was driving. He rented a car. And we were driving from Los Angeles to Big Sur, which I think is about a 10-hour drive. And people warned me, you have to get to Big Sur before it gets dark because it's very dangerous, high mountains, no lights, thin roads. So we were driving up and he stopped. This was in about 1989. He stopped to get petrol at a gas station. And I went to a payphone to make a call. And after my call, I hung up and there was a telephone directory was open at the phone. And I looked down at it, and on the top of the page, the name Liss. Now Gary's name was Gary Liss. And I looked down and there was a Gary Liss. Now we're in Malibu, California. And I looked at the, this is a true story. The phone booth's still there, you can see it. I looked at the address, it said something like 23750 Malibu Road. Right above the phone booth was the street sign and it said Malibu Road, the 2300 block. And I looked just down the road and there was the address that was here. Now, I hadn't seen Gary in 17 years. No communication. I had no idea in the world where he was. But I was thinking if it may not be him. But if it is, I can't just say, Gary, you know, nice seeing you, but I have to go to Big Sur. So I thought, next year I'll come back to see you. So I went to Big Sur, Father B. Griffiths, did kirtan with all the monks, and discussed Isha Upanishad. The next year, I personally, all alone, I borrowed a car, and I drove to that address. And when I arrived, the house was demolished, and there was nothing there. It was an empty lot. So I was really confused. So I asked a neighbor, do you know who lived there? They said, no, I don't know who lived there. America's like that. So I was just walking around an empty lot. Now, Malibu Beach is one of the most wealthy, sophisticated parts of all of America. Many people in Beverly Hills, they have a house in Malibu Beach to be near the ocean. Now, where this house was, there was a tennis court right behind the house. Right behind that was a beautiful home, and right behind that was the Pacific Ocean. So I was just standing in this lot, and people were looking at me because they're not accustomed to some swami walking around Malibu Beach. So then somebody comes out of the house. He was really muscular. He looked like some sort of a bodyguard or something. And I was thinking, I might be in trouble. He might be, because I'm right in front of his tennis court. And he came toward me, and I was looking at him. He was looking at me. And when he came closer, I said, Gary. And he said, my name. And we embraced. And he took me back into that mansion. It was Uncle and Aunt's house. His uncle and aunt is Shelley and Donald Sterling. They're very wealthy people. They're the largest real estate holders in Beverly Hills. They own over 150 apartment buildings. They own a bank, a five-star hotel on Wilshire Boulevard. And they own a national basketball team called the Los Angeles Clippers. Something like cricket in America's basketball. And he was living on top of their garage, and that was demolished because they were rebuilding it. Now, when I knew Gary, he was skinnier than me. And now, you know, his arm was bigger than me. And he said, you know, we have some catching up to do, Swami, you know. So I told him what I was doing, and he told me what he was doing. Would you like to hear what he was doing? He traveled for 7 years, hitchhiking, through India. Then he went through every country of Africa. Then he went through every country of South America. Finally, he came back to America, up Mexico to California, where his Aunt Shelley and Uncle Donald lived. And he decided he was going to go to college. And while he was in India, he became so deeply impressed by Mahatma Gandhi, he decided, I want to become like Gandhiji. Gandhi was a lawyer, I will become a lawyer. So he went to Chico State University and then Pepperdine College and got his law degree and started practicing law. But after some years, he realized, this isn't at all like Gandhiji. He's haggling with other lawyers and courts and lawsuits. But the thing is this, after 7 years of traveling, mostly through third world countries, he had malaria, he had typhoid, he had hepatitis, he had, not hepatitis, jaundice, he had all kinds of dysenteries. He was emaciated. So while he was in college, he decided to take a course in bodybuilding to get his health together. And within a couple of years, he was the regional champion bodybuilder. And the Malibu Gym, which is the place where many of the Hollywood people and other big people from Los Angeles area, they go for training, they invited him to be a trainer. So he felt, I like to do that better than law. So for the last 20 years, he's physical trainer at the Malibu Gym, teaching all these movie stars how to look nice. So he looked at me, and he said, Swami, how could we still be friends? You know, 17 years have gone, and we've gone totally different ways. He said, you're a Swami. He said, your goal of life is you're traveling around telling people that you're not your body. Your body's perishable, is going to die. That you are an eternal soul. That you should realize your soul. You're telling people that you're not the body, you're the soul. And my whole life is teaching people how to have beautiful, healthy bodies. So what do we have in common? How can we still be friends? May I tell you the answer I gave? I said, my Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, who I met in Vrindavan, and who transformed my heart, and who I gave my life to assist him in his mission of compassion. The compassion that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas to give the world, I saw embodied by my Gurudev. And as small and insignificant as I may be, I felt I want to assist him. It's the most precious gift in my life, just to try to assist him in giving this prema, this love to people in this world. I told Gary that my Gurudev told me that the body is a temple of God. And God is within our hearts. Just like God is in the temple, God is in the temple of our body, in the temple of our hearts. So Gary, you teach people how to take care of the temple, and I'll try to explain to people what to do inside the temple. And in this way, we can be a team. And from that day on, we've been a team. And whenever I go to California, I visit Malibu, and he, all his clients and all his relatives and all his friends and everything, wonderful people. He has special programs where he introduces me. And they're all people who he trains. One girl came every week, every year. I go there every year. One girl, she's a beautiful woman with blonde hair and blue eyes, and sannyasis aren't supposed to go into so many details like this. But she just happens to be 6'9" tall. How do you say that in India? Does everyone know 6'9"? I'm 5'6". So she's somebody that you have to look up to. And we'd all sit on these couches in this lawyer's house. This lawyer lives in Dana Point, and their next door neighbor is a famous musician named Bob Dylan. Have you heard of him? But we always have the program there. It's a beautiful place. And we're sitting on the couches, and she's sitting on the floor, and her head is our level. And one year, Gary secretly invited my father to come. Because when my father and mother came to India to see what I was doing and who I was with in 1989, they wept in joy. They were so proud, so happy. And to this day, their best of friends are our devotees in Bombay. Whenever our devotees in Bombay are in the Chicago area, they visit my father. Right? Yogesh Nikunja Vihari is very good friends with my father. My mother also, she passed away a couple of years ago. Very dear friends. Gary secretly invited my father to surprise me. That year, this 6'9" beautiful lady named Carolyn, she happened to bring her boyfriend. He was 7'1". And he was a famous basketball player for the National Basketball League. The New Jersey Knicks or something like that. But he was so humble. He came to Gary and he said, "I feel so contaminated, but I really want to meet this Swami, but I feel so contaminated and so small in front of a religious man." And I said to Gary, "He feels small in front of me." I feel really small in front of him. So we talked for some time. It was very sweet. But in this way, you know, Gary brings his friends, and every year practically Gary comes to India and spends a month with us in Bombay. According to Gurudev's principle, he teaches how to make the body nice, and I try to help them understand what you can do within your body. Reality is so beautiful. It's so miraculous. If we just put our hearts and our lives in the hands of God. These are a few of the subjects within the book, The Journey Home, which I was told to speak on tonight. I'll say one more thing, then I'll end. My mother and father. I'm sure most of you are mothers and fathers. Can you imagine your 19-year-old son writing letters from Iran and Afghanistan? One letter I wrote to them from the Himalayas saying, "I'm living in a cave. in the jungles of the Himalayas, and I'm listening to a butterfly chanting the holy syllable, Om. Now, a middle-class American family, I thought they would be proud of me. They were absolutely in anxiety, worrying about me. They were crying, but there was nothing they could do because I never gave a return address because I didn't have one. When I finally came back home after several years, I saw my mother on a shelf on a shelf in her kitchen. She had a whole library of vegetarian cookbooks because she knew I was a vegetarian. And she was studying for months for when I came home she could cook for me vegetarian food. That's a very selfless, loving mother. I betrayed her. I loved her, but this calling for God, I could not say no. I would be an empty, hollow shell if I didn't seek the ideal that I yearned for. But through it all, and when she passed away, my two brothers and my father, they decided that she loved your people in India so much and she was so proud of you. We're going to do something that our family has never done in history. We're going to cremate her body and give you her ashes to bring to India. And with over 2,000 devotees in Sri Mayapur, Bengal, on the banks of the Ganges, I offer 2,000 devotees chanting Krishna's holy names and praying for my mother, I offered her ashes into Mother Ganga.